Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We are going to turn the page and consider Yahweh's testimony. We had just begun a review of what is known as the Ten Commandments, even though there's not a single commandment among them. There's only one of the ten statements that's actually written in the imperative mood. And in the nature of the imperative mood in Hebrew, virtually every time it's used, it does not actually communicate a command, but instead volition about expressing the desire of it, of the speaker, making a statement that is being communicated under the auspices of free will for the recipient of that statement. But before we go to this review of the ten statements that Yahweh etched on the two tablets of stone, I would like to welcome Carol, who's calling in to from Baltimore to the program. I understand she has a question on death and animals. Hello, Carol.
Hi. I'm sorry. I'm a little emotional.
Okay.
I just wanted to know if do animals just cease to exist when they die?
It sounds like you just lost a cherished pet, either probably a dog here recently. Is that correct? Oh, a kitty. Okay. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question. Now, what we know about human souls is that the vast preponderance of human souls cease to exist upon their death. Now, that's the vast preponderance of human souls. Yahweh speaks of the death and destruction of a soul routinely. It is very relatively few souls that become immortal. And of those souls that become immortal, there's probably more that are immortal, separated from God in Sheol, than are those who embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant and spend eternity with God in his home. So the overwhelming preponderance of human souls simply cease to exist upon the demise of their earthly lives. As for animal souls, God does not specifically say, you would normally think, okay, you know, I can't imagine that in eternity we're going to spend time in heaven with the soul of your ordinary garden slug, a snake, or something like a vulture, which all have souls, because the difference between an animal and a plant, according to God, is that animals have a conscience, have consciousness, which is the soul, the ability to respond to the environment. And that's what a soul is, and all animals have them, from the cutest little kitty and the most beloved dog, all the way up to, down to, if you will, snakes, aardvarks, and platypuses. So since we know that the vast preponderance of human souls don't survive their mortal existence, the natural inclination would be that nor would animal souls. Now, that said, there is also indication that eternity will be, we will share our eternity with life. You see, when Yahweh was in the Garden of Eden, the Gan Eden with Adam, his conversations with Adam, his experiences with Adam, really indicates to us what our eternity is going to be like, what the children of the covenant are going to experience with Yahweh. And there's actually two statements that God makes about his interactions that are really interesting. One of them is God was walking with them, which indicates that we're going to be up on our feet. We're going to be going. We're going to be going doing things together. And the second was that he brought all of the animal life that he had conceived before Adam, and he talked about them. And so God really loves animals. He just thinks that that animal life is really interesting and special. And he's shown there explaining and parading animal life before Adam. And under those circumstances, with God's affinity for animals and his interest in animals and the fact that life is probably the most interesting aspect of the universe, it seems inevitable to me that we're going to share eternity with animals. Now, personally, because I have been quite enamored with the pets that we've had as part of our family over the years, I am hopeful that that in eternity we're going to be able to reconnect with some of these wonderful souls. Is there a definite answer other than the suggestions that I've shared with you here? No, that's all I can tell you.
Well, in the garden, he made the animals first of all to be the companion of man, didn't he?
No, he really doesn't say they're a companion of man. No, he speaks of the creation of animals on successive epochs of time, where mammals are the last of the animals that are conceived, and he explains that the kind of the order of things in terms of creating plants first, and where plants were conceived, and how they come out of the sea, and how animals were conceived a significant period of time later, and ultimately Homo sapiens, the man, became the last animal designed. But other than saying that that all of creation was for our enjoyment, and companionship is the most wonderful part of enjoyment, so there's a direct inference there. But did he say it deliberately? No. But he did infer it. So I think you can go to that point comfortably.
But didn't he say that the reason why he created the woman was because he found no suitable one among the... Didn't he try that first, and when that didn't work, that's when he made the woman?
Well, he didn't say so much that that there was no suitable companion for man amongst the animals, but he did infer... I mean, the inference was that man wanted a companion. You know, the animals had companions among their kind, and man did not have a companion among his kind, and so the woman was created, but realistically, that story is more about how men and women come together as husband and wife in marriage, and how in a family and home setting they conceive children and nurture them and raise them and help their children grow, teaching them, sheltering them, protecting them, because the story that he's telling here now is all about the covenant, which is a family-oriented relationship. And so that presentation really is designed specifically to talk about the birth of the covenant, which is the reason that the universe exists. So that's the primary thing you ought to gain from that, and to make a conclusion as to whether or not there will be animals in eternity is a pretty significant stretch.
No, I guess it was.
Yeah. I can tell you though that I'm wholly sympathetic with you. I've grown up with Labradors being my choice for family dogs, and our labs have always been integrated into our family. Have been a big part of our family. They've been wonderful companions. I have an old lab now that we are. We enjoy very much. So I can tell you that my sympathies are with you. My requests have to ya are, you know, it's your call, and it seems to me that you enjoy animals a lot, and that eternity would be substantially deprived of its interest without animal life. So I strongly suspect that we're going to enjoy animal life with Yahweh, the one who conceived this going forward. So Yes, and we know also there's going to be animals in during the Millennial Shabbat, and the Millennial Shabbat is a celebration of returning to the conditions found in the Garden of Eden. So there will be a time where God will exist again on this earth along with animal life. And, you know, never lose sight of the fact that man is an animal, that the only uniqueness of humankind is that God gave us a nesalma. And the nesalma is our conscience. Well, the soul, nefesh, is our consciousness, our ability to perceive and respond to our environment. And to Yahweh, our consciousness, our nefesh, is our conscience, our nefesh, is the seat of judgment. It's what our education and politically correct institution is are trying to annul, is the ability to examine the evidence that we see before us, the information that we see before us, and respond to it in a reasonable, rational, and moral way, is the uniqueness of humankind. God specifically said he gave us this nesalma. So other than the nesalma, which is a conscience, the ability to exercise good judgment, you know, man is an animal, and as an animal, we have a soul, and all souls are mortal. Souls only become immortal when they're associated with a spirit, and there are two spirits acting in this world, both Yahweh's set-apart spirit, which can make us immortal and members of Yahweh's covenant family, and also the fallen spirits that we consider demons, those associated with the adversary, HaSatan, which is the basis of really most religious practices and religious faith. So, Carol, I hope that helps a bit, and I my sympathies are to you with the loss of your companion and good friend. We've got Glenn still on the phone. Glenn, did I do a reasonable job of explaining your position relative to the potential, in fact, the likelihood for long-standing malfeasance on both political parties, whether it be Reagan or Bush, versus the what we witness now under Obama?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yes, that's what I understand. Is I know we're just going into the complexities if people aren't inclined to process them.
Yes. Yeah. So, Glenn, we've actually reached a break. We'll come back to Shattering Myths after the commercials and consider whether or not it is appropriate for us to follow Yahweh's advice and to disassociate ourselves from the influence of government and religion. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. I'd like to speak a little bit about Yahweh's testimony. He inscribed 10 statements on two tablets. There are 77 Hebrew words on the first of those two tablets, 77 Hebrew words on the second. The first tablet has, in those 77 words, presents three sweeping statements. The 77 words on the second tablet present seven universal instructions. It would be germane for us to know, too, that while Salem Radio News spoke about the biblical principles of marriage, the Christianity actually has no concept of the covenant. In fact, they don't like the covenant that Yahweh established in his Torah, and that's why they have a new one. And that's why there is a New Testament, because they don't like the existing covenant that Yahweh had established. It also is important to know that that conservative Christians, when they show their animosity towards homosexuality as their primary decree, are taking Yahweh's instructions way out of context. Well, Yahweh is not fond of men having sex with men, and several times mentions that it is inappropriate for men to have sex with men. Just as he says it's inappropriate for men to have sex with their daughters, it's inappropriate for men to have sex with their mothers. He goes on to talk about the fact that it's inappropriate for men to have sex with animals. And so God describes a lot of inappropriate sexual activity, but homosexuality isn't specified significantly beyond any of the other inappropriate sexual activities, including bestiality, including incest. The one sexual, if you will, aspect of human behavior that God is specifically targets to say, now this is really important. Pay attention to this. I'm going to list this one aspect of human sexuality, if you will, of the relationships that humans choose to form, and say this one is really important. And it isn't bestiality, it isn't incest, and it isn't homosexuality. Which one do you think it is? It actually made the top seven list in terms of important instructions on human behavior. It's adultery. Yet how many Christian pastors do you see out there that are on a crusade to make adultery criminal in the United States? You know, adultery is not criminal, and you can commit it. Look at Tiger Woods. I mean, he had more adulterous interactions than there are holes on a golf course. And yet there's no criminal penalty associated with being adulterous. So why aren't Christians trying to criminalize adultery, since it made the top seven list? Homosexuality didn't. Ever think about that? Do you think maybe it's perhaps that in terms of adultery, in terms of sexual interaction between unmarried partners, and adulterous behavior amongst married partners, that you will find more of it among Christian pastors than probably anywhere else? That Christian pastors, as they get involved in their counseling, often engage in adulterous activity? You think maybe that's the reason they don't want to follow Yahweh's example and speak of adultery? Now, why did Yahweh speak of adultery as being in his top seven list and not list bestiality or incest or homosexuality in that top seven list? It's because Yahweh is focused on the covenant. For the covenant to be effective, it has to be a monogamous relationship. The promises for both parties have to be honored. God has made it really clear in the first statement that he etched in stone that you're not going to exist with a God other than Yahweh. If your focus is on a Jesus Christ, you aren't coming into heaven. There'll be no Allah worshipers in heaven. And so it has to be a monogamous relationship. You can't have a relationship with God if you've got a relationship with an imaginary God. That's the issue. The covenant, and the Hebrew word bereth for covenant, is also the Hebrew word for a marriage vow. Marriage vow and covenant relationship are exactly the same word in Hebrew. Realizing that, that's what he's speaking about in terms of adultery. When Yahusha revealed the divorce decree through the prophet Hosha, which means salvation, he specifically said that because of the infidelity, the adulterous behavior of the children of Yisrael, that he had no choice but to divorce them. That relationship, however, will be reconciled with the reaffirmation of the covenant upon his return. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering This. When we look at the 10 statements that Yahweh etched, 77 words on each of two tablets in stone, what we find is, to begin, the author of the Torah introduced himself by name. Very few things are as important as that. God has a name. It's only one name. It's Yahweh. Yod Heh Wah Heh. When he wrote his name on those tablets, he would have used the original alphabet, the original Hebrew alphabet during the time of Revelation, which was a pictographic alphabet. And the reason the pictographic alphabet was so important is that even if you could not phonetically pronounce the sounds, and Hebrew was the first phonetic alphabet in recorded human history, is that even if you could not read and therefore pronounce those sounds, you could tell what the words meant because the words were comprised of pictures. In the case of Yahweh's name, when he wrote his name and you looked at his name, you could figure it out You knew what his name meant, what it was conveying to you. Now, I've shared this before, but since he introduced himself by name at the beginning of the first statement that he etched in stone, it bears repeating. What is the first, therefore the most important letter in Yahweh's name? What does it convey? The upper arm is reaching down. The forearm is reaching out. And at the end, there is an open hand. So the single most important aspect of God's name, Yahweh, is an arm reaching down and out to us with an open hand. Now, there's so much that can be learned by that. When a father reaches down and out to a child, doesn't a father do it the exact same way? Isn't an arm and hand being stretched down and out to us a sign that someone wants to lift us up? Do you fear an open hand or a closed fist? Which is used to strike? Which instills fear? Which even instills the concept of power? Don't you embrace and grasp an open hand? Isn't the open hand the hand of friendship, of association? There is so much that can be known by knowing God's name and knowing how he wrote it. In a very real sense, Yahusha is the arm and hand of Yahweh. In fact, the term that is used throughout the prophetic writings in the Torah to describe the sacrificial Lamb of God, Zeruah, is the Hebrew word for arm, shoulder. And the letter that we find at the beginning of Yahweh's name was originally called a Yod. It's been corrupted by Rabbinic Judaism to a Yod. But it's a Yod. It means hand. Yahusha is the hand of God. Here to lift us up. And so that's the first and foremost letter in his name. God reaching down and out to us with an open hand of friendship to lift us up. There are two letters that are repeated in Yahweh's name because the covenant is a relationship. The covenant was established initially between a couple, Abraham and Sarah, his wife. And so we have two people representing the covenant in Yahweh's name. Those two people, are they on their knees? No, they are shown in the original alphabet standing up. Are they cowards, their head bowed? No. In fact, they are depicted not only standing up, but looking up. In fact, the Hebrew letter for the He in Yahweh's name is based upon the Hebrew word for behold. Pay attention. Notice. Look up. See. Use your eyes. Be observant. That's the letter that is repeated in Yahweh's name is all, not only indicative of Abraham and Sarah who comprised the covenant of being married and bearing and raising children, living in a family, but of also of standing, not bowing down in God's presence, looking up to him, noticing him. But the arms on those two individuals as they were drawn in the first letter for Yahweh's name show us two arms and hands reaching up to God. Why? Reaching up because he's offering his hand to lift us up. But you know, the hand of a father can't lift up a child unless the child reaches out and up to their father. That's why it's called a covenant relationship. Both of us need to respond for it to work. Two people reaching up to God. That means that in God's name, there are five hands. The two individuals plus God's, the first. Just so coincidentally, we look at our own hand. Well, there are five fingers. because we were conceived in God's image, in the image of what was important to him, which was the covenant, which is his name that we, as children of the covenant, bear. Yada, Yahweh. Just so coincidentally, there happens to be five terms and conditions of the covenant. Five things that God asks of us if we wish to participate in the covenant. It says there are five fingers on our hands. One of them is in opposition, our opposable thumb. God asks us to be opposed to religion and politics. That's the first requirement, the first condition of the covenant, to walk away from our country, to walk away from Babylon, which is the corruption of religion. Followed by four requests, and those four requests are to trust and rely upon Yahweh instead, to walk to Yahweh so that he can make us perfect, to observe every aspect of the covenant so that we come to understand it and therefore can respond to it, and to raise our children so that they can become God's children, so that we, as parents, circumcise our sons. And guess what? Not so coincidentally, there are five benefits of the covenant. Just as there are five hands in Yahweh's name, just as there are five fingers on our hand, there are five benefits of the covenant. Those five benefits are facilitated by the first four Moed Mikre. They are eternal life through Passover. They are perfection through matzah, unyeasted bread. They are adoption into God's covenant family on Bukurim, first fruits. And they are God's willingness and ability to enrich us, desire to enrich us with his teaching, and empower us with his spirit on seven Sabbaths, the present, the promise of seven, Shavuah. Five benefits, five conditions, five fingers in the hands, five hands in Yahweh's name. The middle letter between the two individuals that are standing up is the waw. In Hebrew, the waw is the single most repeated concept in the whole of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. It is in English, it is most often translated and. And means you're connecting things. Here's a thought. So there is the covenant and therefore children. Through the covenant and children, we have a family. You know, Abraham and Sarah coming together to conceive Yishak, laughter. And means you connect these things. One thing is in addition to another. Man and God, 6 plus 1, equals God's version of perfection, 7. The law speaks of being increased and being added to, which is the entire purpose of the covenant, when we reach up to God's hand and participate in his covenant, allowing him to lift us up, then we are increased. All of the benefits of the covenant are added onto us. The waw in Hebrew, in the original alphabet that Yahweh used to etch his name in stone, was conveyed by way of a tent peg. A tent peg. A why? What was the purpose of a tent peg? Well, in that day, homes were tents. And so the tent peg was used to increase the size of a home. You know, the sturdier the tent peg and the sturdier the central upright pillar was of the tent, the larger the tent could become. And what else does the tent peg do? It secures the tent so that it does not blow over or fall over in wind or other adverse conditions. So through the covenant, God increases the size of his family and home, and he makes his children more secure. That is what is conveyed by the letters that comprise Yahweh's name. Now, absolutely none of this is known to Christians. You know, in that commercial break where SRN was talking about, oh, this great travesty of the Supreme Court banning any ban on gay marriage, and they called it the biblical concept of marriage, there isn't one Christian in a million that understands anything that we've just said, that embraces anything we've just said. They don't know, they don't use Yahweh's name. In fact, they have so corrupted Yahusha's name, which is just a mission statement, an identity designation. Yahusha means Yahweh saves. They've so corrupted his name as to completely disassociate their religion from Yahweh. It is a travesty. But even worse than those travesties of not knowing Yahweh's name and therefore not understanding any of these stunningly valuable insights regarding God's nature as our Father, wanting to lift us up, and the fact that he should not be feared but instead revered for having the open hand extended to us, and that two people standing up as opposed to bowing down in worship and being secured by this covenant. What do we have Christians doing the world over? Replacing Yahweh's name with Satan's title, the Lord, and therefore miscommunicating and misunderstanding virtually everything about God. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having the enjoyment of considering everything that God conveyed to us by writing his name in stone. And just to think about how utterly disgusting it is that Christian and Jewish religious theologians, scholars, and clerics chose to erase God's name and everything that we can learn by it, and they then replaced his name with Satan's title, the Lord, conveying exactly the opposite. A Lord does not reach down to his subjects with an open hand. A Lord owns them. A Lord possesses them. A Lord controls them. Lords are to be feared. What do people, what do the common people have to do as they approach a Lord? Bow down to him. It is the antithesis of a father. It's the antithesis of the symbolism written in Yahweh's name. And yet these Christian theologians have deceived billions of people by replacing Yahweh's name with Satan's title, the Lord. They did so even in this statement. If you read any Christian Bible presentation of the first statement, it reads, I am the Lord your God. Forgive me, for that's not what he said. He said, I am Yahweh, your God. And yet Christians will believe that they're spreading the truth. They will talk about biblical principles. And yet they took the most important name in the universe and not only disassociated it from their perceived Savior, Jesus Christ, but they replaced Yahweh's name with the title that he offered to Satan because it describes Satan's ambition as the Lord. Why would anyone in their right mind put their faith in a religion that is this disingenuous, this errant, this deceitful, this corrupt? Why? Why would anyone expect that faith in a religion that changes, convolutes the single most important aspect of God's teaching to us, that he has one name and that his name is extraordinarily meaningful, and they replace his name with Satan's title? Why would they expect that that religion would lead them to God as opposed to away from him? You have to be ignorant or irrational to be religious, to be a Christian. So the author of the Torah, he began by introducing himself by name. His name is Yahweh, although Christians are completely unaware of this because their theologians have robbed them of this vital information. By removing God's name from his testimony and replacing it with Satan's title, the Lord, And in spite of that fact that Yahweh emphasized the role he personally played in our liberation from judgment and human oppression in the first statement, and thus from works-based salvation schemes in his handwritten summation of the Torah, the faithful in religions reject this message because they have been indoctrinated by the likes of Paul or Muhammad into believing that the Torah is an oppressive taskmaster, an arcane and archaic system of old that enslaves and has absolutely no capacity to save anyone. So here is God in the first statement that he etched in stone, saying, I am the one who freed you from slavery. And yet Christians would prefer to believe Paul and to say that the Torah enslaves. To believe such things, you have to either be ignorant or irrational. Those are your only two choices. Now, Jews, who were formerly known as Yehudim, which means related to Yah, were told by Rabbi Akiva and later by the Rambam, Maimonides, that Hashem, the name, should never be spoken, and that allegiance to rabbis and their mitzvah would be equated to righteousness. Equally sinister, Muhammad, by plagiarizing and bastardizing the Babylonian Talmud, hoodwinked Muslims into believing that the God of the Torah, prophets, and Injil, which has been corrupted to Gospels, was Allah, not Yahweh, and that killing Jews and Christians and peaceful Muslims for him would be rewarded with an honored place in the perverted Islamic paradise replete with virgins and rivers that flow with wine. All of that is possible because religious theologians removed God's name from his own testimony. We'll be back with you tomorrow. May Yah bless you all.